Welcome to the Research Works podcast, brought to you in association with Curtin University and the Healthy Strides Foundation. Your hosts are Dr. Dana Poole and Dr. Ashley Thornton, and together we will interview world-leading researchers in the area of child health to support your practice in being more evidence-based.
This week we have a real treat for you. As you know, here at Research Works, we are all about knowledge translation. And the reason for this is to ensure that we can provide young people and their families that we work with the best possible care using the latest evidence and research.
Absolutely. I mean, it's all about providing the right information at the right time so that families can make an informed decision. And I think that's really crucial. And for us to be able to support families through this journey, we need to hear their voice and we need to know what they want and what they need from us as clinicians and researchers.
Absolutely. And in research, we actually often refer to this as involving consumers. So increasingly in research, not just in child health, there's recognition that research needs to involve consumers, not just as a token involvement and to tick a box, but to truly embed them and integrate them into the research to make sure that we're asking the right questions in the right way, in a way that's meaningful to the end users of our research and the people who are going to benefit most from that research.
Yeah. And I think, you know, well, Ash, you've done a lot of work in this area, so I know that you're really passionate about this.
You
also engage in something that they call train the trainer in terms of consumer work. Can you talk us through a little bit about what that is? People know about that.
So through the Australasian Cerebral Palsy Clinical Trials Network Centre for Research Excellence, which is led by Professor Ros Boyd, there was an initiative that was started called Train the Trainer, where one of our chief investigators, Anne McKenzie, who is a real champion of consumer involvement in research and community involvement in research, actually trained a bunch of researchers to be able to then go on to train other researchers about how best to involve people from the community and consumers of research into helping them to develop questions, to work out the best way to answer those questions, and to actually help them to interpret the results of their research as well in ways that are meaningful for consumers and community members.
Yeah, it's absolutely so crucial. And for this reason, we're so thrilled to introduce you to our guest today, Jen Pryor. Welcome to the pod, Jen.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, we love that you are here. Look, just a bit of background about Jen. She's a wonderful person. Let's just start with that to start off with. She's a mother of four. She's a nurse, an educator, a friend and a champion for research involving consumers and facilitating her daughter who has cerebral palsy to have her own voice, to have her own say, not just choosing and being involved in therapy or research, but also in life, school, extracurriculars, dreams, aspirations. It's really such a wonderful example, Jen.
Thank you. Can you come with me when I meet new people and give them that every time? That would be fantastic. Oh,
it would be a pleasure to do so. Everyone needs to know more about you. So I think this is going to be really exciting to talk to you about this today.
Yeah, it's so great to have you on the podcast today, Jen. We know that we have so many incredible insights and your lived experience, as it's referred to, that clinicians, researchers and families who do listen to the podcast, we think will really benefit from hearing from you today. So we thought we would talk with you about a paper that was published in Disability and Rehabilitation back in 2013, and it's titled The Paradox of Normalization Through Rehabilitation, Growing Up and Growing Older with Cerebral Palsy. And I think that gives us a really good framework and reference for a lot of what we're going to be talking about with you today. But before we get stuck into the paper, we thought we would help our listeners to get to know you a little bit more. So we've prepared some flash questions.
Sure.
If you're happy to answer them.
Happy to answer.
Great. So 7 questions that will help us learn a little bit more about you. First one is, what is your favourite breakfast?
My favourite breakfast, without a doubt, is an Avo Smash, especially if it's got feta.
Mm.
So at the moment, I'm actually doing an Avo Smash tour of Perth with a friend. So, yes.
I will talk to you later about your findings on that. I like a little pumpkin seed on my
absolutely
Avo and feta smash as well.
Oh,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, guys.
Sorry, I digress. Your ideal holiday?
I think at the moment my ideal holiday would probably be anywhere.
Yeah. Not fussy.
Yeah, I'm not fussy. But to be honest, it would be exploring somewhere I haven't been before. I love going to new places, but I would like it to be warm with a pool. And I would like a constant supply of food and mojitos. I would be very happy with all of that.
I was hoping you were going to mention cocktails at some point.
Yep, that would be perfect.
Yeah.
Lovely.
I think we're going to get along just what is the best job you've ever had?
I was thinking about this one, and my best job that I ever had, I would say every job that I have is my best job at the time until I get my new best job. It sounds a little bit corny, I know, but I actually love being a mother. I think I've got 4 kids, so if I didn't say that, there would be something wrong. But it's probably my favourite job.
That's cool.
Being a mum. But also, side note, at the moment would have to be my photography, and getting paid for that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool. Very cool.
Okay, what is a weird detail about you?
So my weird detail is that I hate pop sticks. So I can't use them, I can't touch them, I can't have ice creams with them, but I also can't have anything that resembles the same type of feeling. So I don't have any wooden spoons in my house either.
Oh, wow.
I hate pop sticks.
Okay. So if you want to eat an ice cream with a pop stick, does someone have to take it off the pop stick for you, or you just can't even go there?
Well, first of all, it would have to be the best ice cream in the world you have to eat it.
Yeah.
But what I actually do is I take the wrapping off and I wrap the wrapping around the pop stick, and then I always leave the last bit of the ice cream so my tongue never touches the pop stick.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm really glad we asked that question. What's your favourite decorating style?
I would say I'm not much of a decorator, but I'm a little bit of old with the new. So someone once said to me that, you know, don't try and buy furniture for your house and, you know, have it all one style. Like if you find a piece that you love, buy it and just make it work. So I think that's me. I've got, you know, old things and new things, and it's a bit eclectic, I guess.
Yeah,
love it.
What's your favourite music genre?
I'm definitely just a what's on the charts kind of girl. Mm-hmm. So, I just listen to the pop music and whatever the kids are listening to. I'm not really that into music that I have a favourite genre, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And what is your best family tradition?
Our best family tradition is caravanning. So we, because there's so many of us, we caravan is the best way to go. So we've literally travelled the whole of WA.
Wow.
In our caravan, and even we've done the longest shortcut in Australia across the middle. So, definitely getting in our caravan, heading off grid, and just being together as a family.
Oh, I love that.
That is really cool. Well, those 7 questions I think I know they sound like just a little bit of fun, but it's also really important as clinicians and researchers to remember that people we're working with are people just like us, and they have things that they want to do. And I think that's really important to know. And if you're going to do a therapy session, do not bring pop sticks.
No pop sticks.
Oh my gosh. And do you know how many times we had pop sticks in our house?
Oh, no.
It was terrible. I'm not touching those, and nor is she.
And how many art projects at school?
Every art project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, important things we do need to know. Mm-hmm. Well, let me just give a bit of a rundown of this article now so we can really contextualize our conversation. And yes, this article is a little bit old. It is 2013, but it draws out some really important information that I think families need to know about. So this article was actually published by Dr. Laura Moll and Cheryl Cott from the Department of Rehabilitation Science, Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto, and it has many implications for rehabilitation. This is a qualitative study that aimed to examine the experience of normalization through rehabilitation for individuals growing up and growing older with a lifelong physical impairment attributable to a diagnosis of cerebral palsy. Their qualitative methodology that used a narrative inquiry involved 9 community-dwelling individuals, which included 3 men and 6 women, aged between 26 and 70 years, ranging from the GMFSS levels 1 all the way through to 5. Their common narrative was that intensive rehabilitation in childhood focused on normalizing their movement, and that once they had reached adolescence, there was, quote, nothing further that could be done, unquote. And by adulthood, loss of skills was observed despite years of rehabilitation during childhood. The experiences described by the participants suggest that the focus on normalizing function in childhood may only serve to emphasize the child's lack of able-bodiedness to the detriment of their sense of self and well-being.
I think there were some really powerful statements made by the participants in this study. Before we get into those specifically, Jen, we were hoping to talk through your experience as a parent and what your main priority was when your daughter first received her diagnosis of cerebral palsy. So, you know, what kind of services did you engage in at the start?
At the start, I guess, obviously my daughter's birth was premature. So the physiotherapy department of that hospital engaged really early with us while she was still in hospital.
Yep.
And then we literally did, I think, what the standard early intervention protocol seems to be, and you know, physiotherapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and a bit of hydrotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our starting point in early intervention.
Yeah. And how much information were you given about the kind of services that you might need?
I'll be honest, I think that first period in early intervention and post-diagnosis was a bit of a blur. I actually don't feel, you know, looking back, that I got given lots of information. It was just like, okay, so she has a disability and this is what we're doing. So I think it was services that we were, you know, expected to engage in with someone with cerebral palsy. So I think I found most of my information in those early days, obviously from the therapist as we were starting therapy and then, you know, moving towards, well, we don't really need to do this. We, you know, you can add this in or whatever. But also other family members in our community became a huge source of information, especially those ones who were like a little bit further along with us. And what I didn't know, I Googled. You know, let's be honest.
I think in the first
12 months of her life, I Googled absolutely everything. So it was a bit of a mix of information sources, but I do feel I probably went in not knowing a great deal.
And then I suppose as time went on, how did you start to make decisions about what kinds of things you would engage in?
There was lots of reasons as to why we made those decisions. I think we became a little bit more knowledgeable, obviously, and I guess I researched a lot. So by research, I mean I obviously read countless articles at the time about cerebral palsy. But I looked at organisations, I guess, across Australia, across the world, and what was considered best practice for the management of cerebral palsy, because I'm not an expert. I didn't know anything about it. So I wanted to see what, I guess, other people did. I guess the other thing that helped make our decisions was back in those days, the funding was different. So physio, speech, OT, hydro, it was all block funded and you got a certain amount of hours depending on the level of disability and that's what you could do. So anything outside of that was self-funded. So if you didn't have the finances, you didn't do it. So, you know, the NDIS has changed the way we can do that as families now. We have, you know, a greater choice in the services we engage in. I think now when we look at what we choose, it's actually not chosen by me, which I think is fantastic. It's chosen by my child because she's a teenager. It's her disability. It's her life. And and I think that's really important as a parent, that I need to listen to what she wants to do and what her goals are. And for her to maintain her disability, you know, her therapy needs or and to achieve her goals, she absolutely has to be in charge of that. So I'm really guided by what she wants to do. More so. And as a parent, I feel like now I'm just there to facilitate that. And I do feel, which I actually love, I'm literally a mum's taxi.
I was just thinking you know as you were saying
That's what I feel like now, and that's great. Whereas before I felt like I was the decision maker, and that's quite a huge pressure as a parent to be making decisions based on information from your medical team and from therapists and, you know, what's best practice, and then sitting back and, as we all do, am I doing enough? So, yeah, I think now our decisions are based on definitely what my child wants to do.
Well, that's fantastic. And back in the earlier days, did you ever feel compelled to travel interstate or internationally for treatment? I know you said that you were looking at what was happening all across the world and what, you know, was considered best practice at the time. But yeah, did you feel like you had to travel to receive that?
I didn't. I think firstly because interstate and international treatment was really cost prohibited. Yeah. It was up to the ten thousands of dollars. But it was not only that; it was a time factor too. So I had four children under four. If I took one away, my husband had to look after three of them.
Yeah.
And we had a new business. So I think first of all, it was a financial thing. I was just like, well, no, so we won't even look at it.
Yeah.
Second of all, what I found was that our medical sort of rehab team and our allied health weren't discussing this. This wasn't a part of her treatment. They weren't going, you should do this, you should definitely do that, you should definitely do this. So I had to ask myself, well, why aren't they telling me to do that?
That's a good point. Yeah.
If they're not saying, if she doesn't do this, she won't be able to, then it's not high on my priorities.
Yeah.
And I think it became more popular as we sort of engaged into school age therapies. And to do that would mean pulling her out of school for extensive periods of time, which sort of went away against how, you know, that inclusive schooling. If you're not there, you're not seen. Yeah. So, I never did and it never bothered me.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And as you said, you're a mum of four, so life was clearly very busy already. How did you balance out the need for therapy in the early years against the needs of your family as a unit?
So as you said, I had four children and three were under three. So I think the final baby grew up in the car. But I think in that early intervention, I was still really learning, you know, about what her disability meant for her.
Yeah.
And there was so much therapy and I saw other families doing so much therapy.
Yeah.
But I soon realised that it just wasn't sustainable for, you know, my mental and emotional health and our family situation, but also for my child to be sort of doing everything. So I really had to find a balance really quickly. And I remember I got given a piece of advice by a physio when my daughter was 4 months of age and I was talking about this. And she said, oh, my goodness, you don't have to do this on top of everything. You just have to make it be a part of your life. Yep. So it needs to be a part of your normal everyday life. And she gave me an example of, you know, how changing a nappy could be a physiotherapy exercise.
Yeah.
And that was like the best thing because I always felt that therapy was on top of life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And until I made that mind shift and making it a part of life, it actually became easier for me to sort of manage. And I was very, very mindful really early on that I didn't want my child to look back, you know, when she was 17 and go, you know what, Mom, all I did was therapy.
Yeah.
You had me in therapy 5 days a week and I just don't want her to feel like that. So we put systems in place really early. You know, there was therapy was never more important than a birthday party invitation. It was
wonderful.
Or sleepovers or, you know what, if she was tired or bored that day or just didn't want to do it, it's like, you know what, sorry, we're not doing therapy. We never did therapy in the school holidays.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That was our time off. And I always told the therapist, like, you know what, we're probably not going to wear our AFOs either.
Yeah.
So we just really found that there had to be a balance and I wanted to make sure that she had, and I hate using the word normal, but I wanted to make sure she had that normal kid experiences and that normal childhood that her siblings got to do as well.
Yeah.
Look, I think that's so vital. And the fact that, like you said earlier, that your daughter's now, you know, in charge and she's making decisions about what she wants, that obviously reflects a positive experience on her part, you know, on what she was engaged in.
Yes.
She's resentful about it.
Yes, definitely.
And she sees the value of it and where it fits in with her life. She can engage with it when she needs to.
And I think the thing that also sort of confirms it, I feel like we've done a great job, is that she doesn't see therapy as therapy.
Yeah.
Mm. It's actually just part of her life.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So yeah, that's just a part of who she is and her CP and that's what she does.
Yeah. Oh, that's really great. Well, let's use that now and sort of talk about the contents of this paper and why it's sort of resonating a little bit with us at the moment. And it's this whole idea of normalization. And normalization was heavily shared across the participants in this paper. There are quotes like, I think there's this whole business of normalcy and the idea that we're going to try and make this child walk as close as possible, like as close as possible to the normal body or the idea of the normal body. And that was a direct quotation from an adult. So casting your mind back now, Jen, to those early years where the milestone is walking, you know, we know that's really powerful. We know it's really important and it's something that is in your mind. What were your expectations at the time?
Gosh, it was such a focus on walking, and it's not until I read the article that I, you know, reflected back and I was like, you know what, our whole early intervention was about getting her to walk.
Yeah.
And you know, that like it said, we'd do all this rehab. She would have all this input into all these different, you know, speech and OT and physio, and that she would somehow achieve, you know, this normal function of walking that was, you know, considered, you know, appropriate. And I think, you know, what we have to remember too is she has cerebral palsy. So no matter how hard she tries, her gait is never going to be considered normal.
Yeah.
It's going to be considered normal for cerebral palsy.
Yeah.
So it was always sort of important to have, you know, a developmental standard. Like, you know, it's important to have a standard. But I think it's really important to remember that that's not the only way that things are done.
Yeah.
And I sometimes wonder if because, you know, we were so focused on walking and doing this normal walking pattern, that did I actually stop her from developing? Because I was like, oh no, stop. Okay, now we're going to put one foot and we're going to make sure we do a heel strike. You know, like, do we have to focus so much on what it looks like getting from A to B? Isn't it sometimes more important that we just get from A to B? So I did find that early intervention was definitely about reaching that milestone and, you know, trying to prevent bad habits from forming and, you know, making sure her walking was as normal as possible. And when you have, a child with a physical, you know, developmental delay, that end goal, it's quite a, you know, pressure cooker. Like it's quite a lot of pressure. And I think, I guess in hindsight, I wonder what that message was to her as well. Like, we're constantly trying to fix your walking. And so I think in the end I really started celebrating just the fact that no matter what it looked like or whether, you know, she was independently walking or walking with a frame or her crutches, that her walking was perfectly normal for her. And I just think I worry sometimes when I look back that potentially because we were so focused on, you know, achieving that standard, that I may have sacrificed some of her actual, you know, development, because I would stop her mid walking to concentrate on a heel strike or whatever. You know, like, for example, you know, in my mind, knowing that I shouldn't let her W sit. But when I did let her W sit, she had her hands free and it meant she could play. So I'm like, but that's bad, but that's good. So it was quite overwhelming to sort of, you know, what really focusing on that end goal. I wish, you know, in hindsight, I wish perhaps I'd just focus on what was happening and what would be.
But that, I imagine, is a process to go through as well, isn't it?
Definitely.
I mean, I think you can look back hindsight and go, I wish we could have done this. But, you know, at the same time, you know, as a therapist, and I think to all the kids that, you know, I treated 10, 15 years ago compared to the knowledge I have now, you know, I will be the first to admit that, you know, sometimes my language is around, you know, let's look at, you know, longer steps and that kind of language. Without realizing, it was never maliciously done, but you use that to describe movement, but you don't know the impact that has on a person and how they see themselves. So now moving forward, I'm just really thoughtful about that. And my whole approach now is in, you know, listening to things that you say, Jen, and other families, is the fact that it's important just to be able to get from A to B.
Absolutely.
Even if it's in a walking frame. And even if you've got to provide a bit more support in the walking frame, the fact that they can do it.
Yeah.
Let's celebrate that and achieve that, because they love it. They could could do it.
Absolutely.
And we don't want them striving and using all of their energy to take five steps when by the time they get to the destination, they're knackered.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? And I think it's really important because what I felt that that message sent was that if you can't walk or you're unable to, then your life is going to be unhappy or unmeaningful.
Yeah.
And I don't want that message for my child that if you can't walk or you have to use your wheelchair that, oh, wow. Like you're not going to live this rich and wonderful life. Yeah, so I think when there was so much focus on achieving that developmental milestone, that potentially, like you said, Dana, there was this message that we're sending to our children about the importance of walking, where it should be the importance of mobility.
That's right. Yeah. Mobility. Yeah. For function, for fitness,
absolutely.
You know, for enjoyment.
Yeah. And you're right. I found that in those early days, by the time my child got to where her friends were, they'd moved on to the next thing. Yet if she'd been in a wheelchair, she was probably there before them and waiting for them. So you really have to change your mindset about what's important.
Yeah. And what's meaningful
absolutely.
As well for your child and for you as a family. You know, if it's really important for your child to be able to, you know, have a go at walking, you know, with correct technique and that's something that they really want to focus on, wonderful. But if it's not, then, you know, you need to find ways to support and frame the goals in a way that are meaningful for them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Jen, I feel like, you know, there's this whole balance, I suppose, between developmental milestones. Like you said, they're important for us to be able to sort of guide along, but we shouldn't be dictated by them. Just because you can't do one thing on the milestone doesn't mean you can't do the next thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like we have to be very careful not to be too driven by those time points because, like you said, in cerebral palsy, it's different
it is.
It might take a bit longer, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Let's enjoy other things that, you know, that you mentioned as well along the way.
Definitely. And I think if we only focus on your practice becomes sort of focused on that one direction, you're actually missing out on all of the other ways that you can achieve that.
Yeah.
So I think it makes you a better therapist when you're not so directed just to achieving that one endpoint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So reflecting on that then, Jen, what were some of the things that your therapist would say that was helpful and things that were not so helpful?
I could say so much. No, I'm joking. We actually, to be honest, had a really positive early intervention. Looking back now, it feels like a bit of a blur, but I think that's just generally being a parent.
Yeah,
life is a bit of a blur. But I had two really defining moments in my child's therapy life.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was when she was about 18 or 19 months old and her sibling had just started walking and I wanted her to have a walker. Because for me, the social and emotional development of her to being able to be face-to-face and at the same level of her sibling was really, really important.
Mm.
So I went to her physiotherapist at the time and I asked for a walker. And her physiotherapist turned to me and said, oh, my goodness, no. She doesn't know how to walk properly.
Oh.
Which when I read this paper, I'm like, that's exactly that. So I think the thing that really stood out for me there was the therapist wasn't listening to what I was saying. I wasn't asking for a walker because I wanted her to walk. I was asking for a walker for her social and emotional development.
Yeah.
And it also then let me know that therapist was really focused on the normal development and doing things normally.
Yeah.
So I was already like, oh, I don't think we're on the same page. So I did what any parent would do and I walked out of that into the room where there was another physiotherapist and asked for a walker and got one.
Yeah.
And you know what? To be honest, she spent the first month hating every minute of it and didn't walk in it anyway. So it didn't matter. That's not what it was for.
Yeah.
But the therapist wasn't listening. So that was the first occasion. And the second occasion, I remember a little bit later on, my child would have probably, I think, been about 8 or 9. And she was taking some independent steps. And her goal at the time was to be able to walk independently inside. So she was really driven it was her own drive. It had nothing to do with us as parents. She was really driven. And the physiotherapist said to her, well, you'll never be able to walk independently anyway, so let's just teach you how to walk with one stick.
Okay.
So I remember just sitting there and I was so angry because I thought, first of all, you don't get to tell my child what she can or can't do. That's got nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
Secondly, you as a therapist are not listening to the consumer. Mm. You're not listening to the disabled person telling you that what's really important to them is for them to be able to walk inside.
Yeah.
And you're actually, I just found it like, you know, really dismissive of she was trying so hard and taking these little steps, and the physiotherapist was throwing that away and just going, oh, well, that's rubbish. You won't be able to do that. So let's, you know,
so
keep walking. So it was, but it was, it's really good when you can recognize that as a parent and go, wow, we are so not on the same page.
Yeah.
You can't be a part of our team.
Yep.
Because you're not listening to the disabled person.
Yep.
So, yeah, that were probably the two standouts. Everything else, we've been, I think it's been really easy. You know, like my child has, you know, she's enjoyed it. She's been able to advocate for herself. She's been able to, you know, tell me what she does and doesn't like. But I think for her, she's felt like she's just had this normal childhood.
Yeah.
So it hasn't been a negative experience for her.
Yeah. Well, that's a testament, I think, to you and your family and, you know, how beautifully you balance out all of this, Jen. I wanted to touch on, you know, we've talked about this idea of normalcy and, you know, this idea that, you know, often we're trying to fix an impairment and, you know, trying to achieve a milestone, and there's no point walking unless you can do it properly, in inverted commas. And it assumes that people with disabilities are, I suppose, inherently dissatisfied with their bodies and what they're capable of doing, and that, you know, rehabilitation efforts are trying to fix them. So how do you as a parent balance this? You know, for your child, you don't stop doing therapy, but how you approach it becomes quite important. And how do you kind of preserve their confidence in themselves and their self-esteem and body image and things like that?
Sure. I don't know if I'm doing it right, so we'll find out in, you know, years to come if I have. But I think it's body image and self-esteem is the same for all of our children. And I think I work on that process with all of my children. And you're right, we didn't stop doing therapy, but we stopped focusing on things that were purely there for rehab. And to fix her disability. Mm. So we just started participating in activities and opportunities, regardless of whether they were considered therapy and regardless of whether they had any therapeutic outcome.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, in those early days, every toy you bought, it just had to have a therapy purpose, you know. And I remember going, I just want to buy a toy for a toy.
Yeah. So she likes it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that was a really important thing for us. We we stopped worrying about whether it was therapy or not. And obviously we stopped worrying about whether we were doing things normally.
Yeah.
Because what was really important to me was increasing and enhancing her participation in her community, in her school and in her life, because life shouldn't be just about therapy. It should be about doing the fun stuff.
Yep.
Because I want her to grow up and, you know, live independently, and I don't really want her to go to nightclubs, but I know that she will. But you know what I mean? I want her to do all those things that, you know, that rite of passage. So, you know, I think we found, we talked a lot about, you know, being fit and healthy and strong because we talk a lot about her disability, because her disability is definitely part of her identity.
Yeah.
And so we found, you know, through opportunities for mentoring through social media and finding positive experiences of disabilities, because I think as a parent, we are bombarded with this narrative that disability is a tragedy. And I know in those first few years, because I've grown up my whole life seeing that,
yeah.
you know, when you're told your child has a disability, you're like, but I don't want that. Yeah, I don't want their life to be a tragedy. So when, you know, when I started meeting people in her disabled community that had, you know, really positive interactions and experiences, it really, it helps to develop her disability identity, I think, and, you know, developing a strong self identity and positive self-concept empowers her.
Yeah.
And she has to have a clear understanding of who she is and how she fits within her community because she is a part of the disabled community. Having a good mental health and a positive body image and confidence, you know, and pride in her disability is really important. So we, you know, we talk a lot and embrace and accept all different body shapes and sizes. And, you know, like I said, following other incredible disabled activists and disabled identities in our community means that she is seeing these positive images of disability so that she can go out and she can become this empowered, strong, independent young woman that can advocate for herself in the future. So I wanted her to be able to be really proud of who she is and a part of who she is her disability identity. So I don't know if I've got it right or I'm doing it right or, you know, but I feel that I've got this beautiful young lady who is living her best life. She's doing incredible things and she's participating. She has wonderful friends and, you know, as a mum, I can't be happier.
That's all you can ask for. That's so good. And when you talk about that, it really resonates with, you know, we talk a lot about the F words as they come into play. And we know that comes from the ICF framework. And a few weeks ago, we had on the podcast some brilliant professors, Egmar and Carol from Brazil, who were talking about the evidence behind the F words and how that actually drives neuroplastic changes. And it doesn't sound particularly, you know, rocket science-like and, you know, not using it, all these fancy things. But there is the power of looking at each of the components of the F words. And so I thought what would be really cool to do to go through is go through each of the F words with you and just what comes to mind in terms of what it is that you focus on when you put each of those F words. So the first one is function. What does this mean for you?
For actually probably means for my child, but it means that she can do what she wants when she wants. And that she... to me, that's, I think that's as simple as it is. For her to be able to go, I want to do this, and to be able to have the functional ability to do so.
And that's the power of goal setting. If you are going to work on something, that's why you need to know what that person wants to do and what's functionally meaningful. Okay, so the next one is fun.
Oh, that's pretty much her life. So doing something because she wants to, not because she has to.
Fabulous. Friends.
She is the most social person ever and she's a real eclectic friendship caretaker. I love it.
Oh, I love that.
She does. She just collects all of these beautiful friends. But as a parent, when you have a child with a disability, I think that was one of my things. I was like, oh, my gosh, like, you know, hope that she's going to have all these amazing friends and she does. So for me, friendship is the most important thing in her life because as a teenage girl, it's all about the friends.
Love it.
Absolutely. That's really, really cool. I agree with that as a teenage girl.
Yes. And even as a woman of my age now, friends are really important.
Absolutely important. All right. Next one, family.
Family, that's why I had so many, four of us. Family for me is like the most important thing.
Yeah.
Disabled or not, the people that love you the most, they are your family. You know, to me that's everything for all of us, not just my child.
With a disability. That's huge. Fitness.
So we know obviously from research that, you know, kids with disabilities don't have those same opportunities.
Yes.
So for me now, fitness is about fun too.
Yes.
Yeah, so she has to keep fit is obviously a long-term goal for her. It's a part of managing her disability. But it's about, you know, fitness for her is now, it's not about just going to the gym and working out. It's getting out in her wheelchair, cruising around with her friends at the shop. She has to be fit to do that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, she doesn't want to be pushed around. She wants to do it herself.
Yeah.
Right. It's about going and competing in athletics on the weekend and having a great time doing that. Yeah. So for her, fitness and fun is really interrelated.
Yeah.
Because I know I don't do fitness if there's no fun involved.
Oh, yeah. So
to me, it's a bit of both for her.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah. Yep. Love how you said that. And the final one, future.
I think a lot of the time, and again, it comes back to, you know, growing up and seeing, you know, disability portrayed, that when your child is diagnosed with a disability, I think that that sort of your mind skips right ahead to what your future's going to look like. And it's, you know, this instant worry about, oh, what if, how can, what's going to happen? And I just think, now I'm in this position and where her future is her choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what? We'll make it work. If she needs the kitchen modified, that's easy. We'll get that done.
Mm.
But her future is absolutely endless and it's not limited by her disability. And I think once upon a time there was such low expectations for people with disabilities, and I want her to go out and absolutely raise the ceiling and challenge those low expectations.
Yeah.
And go, you know what? I'm disabled. I'm proud and I'm here.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so wonderful. That's really cool.
I love that message. And I love, you know, the increasing presence of people with disabilities in mainstream media and social media and all those things. You know, I think the saying is if you can see it, you can
that's
be
right.
it.
That's right. Yeah. And absolutely. And that's, it's so important for our young kids to see themselves represented because, you know, as you said, you can't be what you can't see.
Yeah. Yep.
And also seeing positive images.
Yep.
You know, we need to change that narrative because, you know, I've spoken to lots of parents where, you know, their young 6-year olds are having such a tough time coming to terms with their disability. And I think, wow, they're 6. That makes me really sad because they're obviously, they're not seeing these beautiful, positive, strong, empowered role models in the media. So that's really important to me.
Jen, when we were talking about the F words, you dropped in a little bit of research and evidence there, which I love. So I just wanted to finish up with some questions around, you know, research and evidence-based therapy and approaches. And how important was it for you that the therapy your child was engaging in was evidence-based?
It was really important. And in the very early days, it was really important to me because there was such a short time period, like, you know, talking about neuroplasticity and this, okay, you know, between 0 and 5, these are the most crucial years. We've got to, you know, do all of this to have the best possible outcomes in the long run.
Yeah.
And so I think for me, because I was balancing life with therapy, what I chose to do, I wanted to make sure I was making the best possible choice for that period of time.
Yeah.
So it was really important. And I think I was probably lucky in lots of ways that some of that choice was block funded.
Yes.
And, you know, young family of 4, new business, we just didn't have the extra money to spend on things outside of what wasn't best practice, I guess. So I was probably lucky.
Yep.
But I also think I was surrounded by people who were doing the best practice in their own practice.
Yeah.
So it was important.
Yeah. So how would you go about finding information about therapies and whether they were maybe, you know, had an evidence base behind them or not?
Well, I think I was really lucky that I did 2 degrees.
Yeah.
And so I spent my life researching.
Yeah.
So I obviously, you know, had the knowledge and skill of where to find things. And now online, like I remember back in the days, like you had to go to the library and pull the actual journal out.
Old school.
Whereas now everything's online.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. And I think, you know, the risk of everything being online too is having the skill to pull apart what is good research and what is bad research.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think if you become widely read, you soon sort of discover in that field what best practice is. I also spend a lot of time asking questions because I love factual information. Yeah. So I would always bombard, you know, her rehab doctors, her physiotherapist. I'm like, yeah, but tell me why. So why do we have to do that? Or what do you think of?
So I did
ask lots of questions. Yeah. And then, of course, because I'm in this disabled community with families, you hear a lot from families as well who are a little bit further ahead of you that, you know, they become a really great resource as well.
Yeah. So just a final question for me. If you could go back to speak to Jen 10 years ago, what advice would you give yourself? And when I talk about advice, I'm talking about things that you might do differently, but also things that you would say, no, Jen, keep doing this. You're on the right track.
Or I would actually go back further than 10 years. So I would go back 14 years ago.
Okay.
So I would go back to the day that I was told my child most likely have a disability.
Mm-hmm.
And it was told in a really medical way.
Mm.
So it was just like, oh my gosh, tell me what's wrong. It was a really overwhelming experience. I would actually, first of all, go back and tell the doctors, hey, don't ever do that again.
Yeah.
Because you actually, the way you told me, you set me up that this is a tragedy.
Yeah.
So don't do that. That would be the first thing I would say.
Yeah.
The second thing I would tell myself was don't waste time grieving and thinking her disability was a tragedy.
Yeah.
Right. And again, that's hard because that's growing up, that's what I was told.
Yeah, sure.
But I would tell myself, don't waste time.
Mm.
And I would also tell myself that it's not a tragedy, it's not a burden, and I don't need to worry about her. She's going to be perfectly fine.
Mm.
I would tell myself also, I think, to really love and cherish each moment and not to be so focused, especially in those early days, on that end goal.
Mm.
Just enjoy what it is and what's happening.
Yeah.
Because tomorrow will come and you can address that day then. So I think I would definitely tell myself those two things. And I'd also probably tell myself, you're totally going to rock it. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
and your child is going to nail it. So, I think it would just be how I reacted.
Sure.
I would want to tell myself differently. Yeah. I don't necessarily think I would change the path and how we did things, because as I said, it was a really a positive experience.
Yeah.
But I would probably tell myself not to feel guilty too.
Right.
Like less is more.
Yeah. Yeah.
So because that was a pressure. I would tell myself those things.
Yeah. I love that. And what would your advice be for researchers and health professionals? Like, what kinds of things can we do better?
Oh, that's a good one. I did think very long and hard about this question actually. Mm. The first thing I would say to researchers and therapists is to help your families make connections.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in this position where you have, you know other families, you know other practitioners, you know other organisers. Help your families make connections.
Mm.
Back in the day where we started early intervention was all within one therapy provider. As I said, it was block funded. And it was a one-stop shop and I was very reluctant to make connections outside.
Yeah.
But that would have been really beneficial at the time. I think also the other thing you need to do, and I would say this to new up-and-coming grads who, who are stepping out for the first time, is get a script.
Yeah.
So have a script for those really difficult questions that you know your families are going to ask you and you don't actually have the answer for.
Yeah.
And it's that fine line because we're probably asking you because we want to know, but don't crush us because we want a little bit of realism but we still want hope. So it's that fine line between being realistic but also, you know in medical research that your child with, a gross motor classification scale 2 is most likely going to do this. But we also know there's kids that operate and suddenly go outside of those and do things that aren't expected. So you don't actually know.
Yeah.
You know what most children will do but not all. So I think know what you're going to say to those tough questions. Mm-hmm. I didn't ask them because I didn't want to know and I didn't want someone telling me, oh, she's not going to walk. Mm. So I didn't ask those ones, those tough ones, but know your answer and have a good one would be, that first thing.
Yep.
And I think the last thing that's really, really important, and I saw a quote once, and it was nothing about us without us. Mm-hmm. So I need you as therapists and researchers to listen to the consumer. Now, yeah. And the consumer's not the mum and dad.
No.
It's the person with the disability. Mm-hmm. So that child is the person that you need to listen to them. Mm. So, you know, you need to empower them so that they can achieve, you know, their highest standard of health and well-being, but their mental health and their self-esteem and disability pride are also right up there, that they can achieve that and live a, you know, a really authentic and meaningful life. Mm. So I know as parents we're in this, you know, unique position where we know our children best. But I don't live with the disability she does, and she's going to live with it for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
So it has to be her that's in control of that.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll only keep doing that and keep wanting to do the things that will help maintain her disability if she's empowered and it's her choice.
Yeah. Yep.
So to me, it's finding that balance between helping parents come to terms with that as well and really empowering the child. And I know I come from a position where I have a child who is really independent and she's physically able and she's also verbal, so she can advocate for herself. So I know that there are lots of challenges sometimes with empowering the child, but it's their life and it's their disability. So they are the ones, it's their voice.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a beautiful note to finish on, I think.
Yeah, such a powerful message. Look, Jen, thank you so very, very much for your time and sharing with us. And like, you know, I'm sure you've all heard through this podcast the absolute value and importance of making sure that we are listening and that we are using the best practices, because they are people and their lives, and we want to be really respectful of the time that they have, because we need to balance life across the lifespan.
Absolutely. Yeah. Life is for living.
That's right.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Jen, for being so generous with sharing your experiences with us today.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. And it was, not only was that my favourite article, the one I've read, but the other one, the F words, is my all-time favourite. Yeah. Oh, so I do try to live life by that one. Yeah. So I literally feel like I've just read, you know, two things that are like, this is me.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well, we'll have the links to all of those articles on our website. So make sure you head over to researchworks.net. But for now, we'll say goodbye and we'll talk to you guys next time. Bye.
Bye.